Welcome, everybody. This is Trapping Radio. This is your host, Clint Locklear. This is the original trapping podcast that's been out. We're getting closer to 400 episodes. That's amazing. We can still keep talking about trapping that much. But I think it's a really cool thing that we got going on, and I'm really enjoying doing that. We're going to talk a little bit about peat moss today, and then we're actually going to look at some more scientific data when it comes to coyotes out of a book that every coyote trapper should try to get their hands on. It's called The Clever Coyote. About the only way you're going to find that book is just keep searching Amazon used books. That's about the only place you're going to find it. It's copyrighted 1951. Amazing, amazing statistics and just observations of the coyote. So we're going to be doing that today. Before we get into that, I want to thank our sponsors. They help make sure the show stays on, server cost and all that other cost that goes along with doing this. And we have some of the best sponsors in the country. The first one is F&T Fur Harvesters. They have everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. So if you're into trapping, hunting with hounds, they got collars and boxes and calls for your predator hunters. And they have about anything and everything you would ever want for trapping. You can look them up at the link below, get to their store. Great guys to deal with. Our other one is Oki Cable and Trap out of Oklahoma. Jeb is an old friend of mine. I've known him for a long time. He's got a full supply line. He's a fur buyer most years. I don't know if he's buying this year. And he's usually selling quite a bit of meat, bobcat, beaver, stuff like that. So if you need some of that, give Jeb a call. Then we have Wildlife Control Supplies, which is out of Connecticut, and a really good company, very professionally ran company, and they have about all you would ever need for your ADC, any type of weird trap, weird situation, exclusion work, all that type of stuff. Plus they have a full line of trapping supplies. Then we have Funky Trap Tags and Supplies, which, as you can tell, they make trap tags and they've been making them forever. They also have a full line of trapping supplies. Alan is also a good friend of mine. We do a lot of business together. He's honest. He's dependable. They do really good on their shipping, and I trust them enough that they ship my product out from their place. So that lets you know how much I trust them. And then we have Dunlap Lures, which is also a good friend of mine, Jeff Dunlap. He makes some really good lure. His dad taught him that. Some of these formulas have been around since the 70s. Some of the formulas are 10, 15 years old after a lot of testing. Jeff does a tremendous job with his lures. And you can find out more about him on Trapping Talk Facebook, biggest Facebook trapping community that there is. He also does stuff on YouTube. And you can just find him all over the place. But he's a really cool guy to get to know if you don't know who he is. So that's our sponsors, and I want to thank them. And if you enjoy the radio show and you're dealing with these guys, which you should be, let them know that you appreciate them sponsoring Trapping Radio. So first thing I want to do is I just got off the phone with a gentleman, and it was about peat moss. And what he was worried about was not the problem. But it is a problem I know that a lot of guys get. We've talked about it before, but I want to go over this again. Peat moss, guys, is what I use with trapping. I don't use the wire screen anymore. Very rarely do I use any type of paper or anything over the trap pan to keep the dirt out. For me, it's just simpler to use peat moss. You can buy it anywhere. Make sure it doesn't have fertilizers and stuff in it. Just raw peat moss. It's cheap. But the question I always get is people know to use it, but they don't know quite how to use it. So I'm going to try to explain this really, really quick. If you're having frozen ground, you can dig your trap bed, get your trap, make sure your trap's going to fit in there good, and put about a quarter inch of peat moss, like a lining inside of the trap. Don't make it 3 inches thick or something because you won't be able to bed it. It'll be wobbly. And then you go ahead and push your trap in, and you kind of use that peat moss as a buffer between the frozen ground and your trap if you need it. But the way most people are using it, the way I use it most of the time, is once I bed the trap, I put peat moss over the pan. So what I do is once it's bedded, I just take a big handful of peat moss and I drop it right on the pan. And then when I drop it on the pan, it's going to be more on top of the pan than there is off to the sides. Because what you don't want to do with peat moss is put so much on there that when your jaws start to close, it's going to act like a stick. And it'll lock up the scissor action of your jaws, which is not what you want to have happen when you put that much time and energy to go catch something. So you're going to drop it right on the pan, and you want to keep it. It doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, don't go crazy with it, but you want it mostly to be inside the jaws. And the way you'll do is, if you don't trust your pan tension, like if you're not using good pan tension, you should be. You don't have to worry about it. But if you're not using a lot of pan tension and you're hair firing your traps, you might want to use a stick or something. But what you want to do is work that pile of peat moss off of the pan. You want to have some on there, but you want to work that big pile around the edges of your pan and let that fall through inside and fill up the gap. So when you sift dirt over your trap, you don't have dirt falling up under there, or sand or loam or whatever it is you're using. And then you can top coat that with dirt, and you're in business. Now, I will say, when I was down there trapping with Jeff and Chip and Carl and all that, which if you haven't heard last week's show, that's a fun one. Jeff does not top coat his peat moss, and he still catches coyotes. So that right there shows that there's, just because I think something should be done a certain way, he sees it a different way. And he catches coyotes, and some of the coyotes in Michigan are a lot tougher to catch in a lot of the places. I can attest to that. So if he's getting away with it, maybe try some without top coating and see what what happens with you. It's not something that I've normally done. I've done that with bobcats. I've just never done it with coyotes. But after seeing Jeff do that over several sets, I could tell that was a habit of his. And it's just one of those things that people trap different. Neither one of them's right. Neither one of them's wrong. It's just the way that it is. So that's how you use peat moss. But like I said, just keep in mind, you don't want to get it really thick over the jaws, because it will clog up a trap. And you'll know this when you go to look at a trap after an animal steps in and fires a trap. The jaws won't be together. So it's almost like a stick or something got in there, and that's not what you want. But this was not this gentleman's problem. He had two traps that were fired and barely pulled out of the base. And if you trap coyotes enough, you're going to see this. Sometimes on a more regular basis, and sometimes you don't see it as often. There's two things that can be going on here. And one of them, there's really nothing you can do about. And one of them, which you're not going to know which one it is, there is a little bit you can do about it, but you don't really know for sure. If you've ever watched a puppy get excited around something that he's not sure about, a lot of them will get on the ground and they will crawl up to it. I don't think it's a submissive thing per se, but it's just a dog habit. And I do believe that pup coyotes around hot lures sometimes will do the same thing. So when they get their body, their chest, their gut, their hip, their elbow, whatever, over that trap, it's going to fire. But very rarely are you going to hold a coyote by the chest or gut or something like that. So when they jump, the trap just barely comes out of the bed. It's fired off. And that's what happens. The other thing that happens a lot of times is on very shallow dirt hole sets, sometimes flat sets, depending on the lure that you use. Some lures will cause more of a rolling response than other lures if the lure is shallow or up towards the top. That's part of the reason I don't like putting lure at the top of the hole ever. Always put it down in the hole. And on flat sets, you're taking a gamble, because it's definitely something they can roll on. And the goal of a flat set is to catch them before they actually take that action. But a lot of times, a coyote with certain lures, especially stuff that's heavy in fish and different products, they're not bad lures, guys. It's just a reaction. If you have a lure that never causes rolling, I'll promise you got a pretty crappy product. Because it doesn't even excite a coyote enough sometimes to want to roll. So people that try to do this, you know, nothing ever rolls at my lures. You just need to take that with a little bit of caution. Everybody's lures will get some rolling from time to time, especially when a coyote gets excited, just like your dog when he rolls in something he finds in the yard. That's what they're doing. But if you make it harder for that coyote to get to the actual product, like in a deeper dirt hole, underneath a rock, something like that, a lot of times it'll stop the rolling. They'll try to dig it out to roll in it. Most of the time, coyotes are trying to get your bait to roll in it. And your lure too, for that matter. So that could have been either one. It could have been an overexcited adult coyote that just rolled, fired his traps off, or it could have been a pup that crawled up. There's not much you can do with that, because that's just what a coyote's gonna do. So I just thought I'd share that before we get into some of the coyote stuff from the Clever Coyote. Now keep in mind, this book was written in 1951. I feel like Mr. Rogers now, putting my glasses on. 1951, and we're gonna read some different things, some of the habits and characteristics and things. But the part that's the coolest to me is what we're gonna finish with, and that's actually how they work together in teams. It's quite phenomenal how a coyote does this. So, habits and characteristics. The coyote is by far the most successful of all the large North American predators in contending with advancing civilizations, contrasted to the North American wolf, which has been eliminated from much of its former habitat, is being gradually restricted to wilder mountainous recesses. The coyote seemed to be holding its own, adapting itself to consistently changing environments, and slowly but surely spreading from the plains to the high mountains, all in spite of the continual warfare against it. In this respect, it is the most astounding mammal. According to the present indications, it will always be part of America's fauna, regardless of the fact that it will never be tolerated, but with few exceptions throughout its vast range, by a majority of the general public. The nature of the beast, together with its physical makeup, are assets that appear unbeatable by the hand of man. Personally, the author, through in full sympathy with whatever measures are necessary in the local control of its depredations, nevertheless feels like Ernest Thompson Sennett. If ever the day should come when one may camp in the West and hear not a note from the coyote's joyous evening song, I hope that I shall live long before have passed away and gone over the great divide. This is the astounding thing to me. I was with some dinner with some neighbors the other day, and they're not trappers. And one of them asked me, he's just curious, do coyotes ever bite people? Now, I did a show a couple shows back where we talk about a coyote that bit a policeman. A couple of days later, someone sends me where another person has been bit. You can Google coyote biting people. They do bite people. They don't really seem to try to kill them, but they do maul them pretty good sometimes. But what you're going to notice with this, and since we're just talking about habits of coyotes, is most of the time when the coyotes get to the point where they're not afraid of humans and they will come up and bite and protect territory and pups and stuff like that, it's in the more urban type settings. It's where the higher population of people, because you get a bunch of city people with a bunch of city silliness, where they look at all animals in a certain way and they don't understand really what that animal is doing. And they try to protect them. They get trapping laws passed. There's no hunting. And these coyotes figure out, against their natural instincts, that there's not really a reason to be afraid of people. People are a source of food, as far as they leave it out that's on the porch for their pets. They may holler at them or whatever. But in the more urban areas, the coyotes' habits have changed drastically. If you were to look at the coyote populations in Chicago, Cleveland, Ohio, different places like that, Columbus, Ohio, where the policeman was bit, you will find that the populations are higher there than they really are out in the country. There's a bigger food source. They're not threatened as much. They don't have farm boys with their 17s, HMRs, rolling down the window and shooting at them because they're in cities. There's lots of free food as far as pets and little punt dogs. There's just a lot there for them to get. Garbage, pet foods, all that type stuff. And they sure enough lose respect for humans. See, where I live here in rural Tennessee, we don't have that. And you really don't hear of coyotes messing with people. They run. Their instincts are still intact. So I was telling the neighbor, yeah, they do, but I don't think you got anything to worry about here. You know, if you, you know, there's a chance they could take a cat or a dog or something like that, or chickens and ducks. But as far as people, we just really don't have that problem. And that's something for you guys that live in more urban areas. I would suggest going to Google, and I think it's not Google Analytics, but it's there's a thing on Google that you can do with your account where you can get alerts. And you can set that up. So if you get an alert, it'll come to your email, I believe, and let you know you have them. And then you'll have a link that'll take you to the post. So if you're in urban areas and you're doing coyote work, or you want to get into coyote work, I think it's a smart move on your part to build a library of coyotes attacking people. And you can put it in a, you know, like a notebook that you got the clear sleeves. You can put the articles in, print them off, have them with you in your truck, and someone goes, I'm seeing these coyotes, but I know they won't bite people. Let me just show you something, ma'am. And you pull that out and let them flip through page after page after page of news reports of coyotes biting people. You know, some of them are really terrible about trying to snatch babies out of baby carriages. It's just the reality of a predator inside of silly cityness. And it could be something that you could really help you with your jobs. It could be helpful if you got to go talk to the city council or the police or anything else, that there is a need for what you do, and here's why. And it's a lot different, guys, than if you're trying to explain it. Let the news stories do the explaining for you. So I just thought I'd throw that in and situation. Now we're going to look at the size and weight. Now this is going to surprise a lot of people. Because if you've trapped in the West like I have, and you've trapped in the Northeast like I have, there is a massive difference in coyote sizes. Often one may be easy misled about the weight of coyotes. And I'm going to go ahead and say this, the same thing for bobcats. Most 40-pound bobcats that people claim are really about 25. If you've ever seen a real 45-pound bobcat, it looks like it weighs 70 pounds. The real weight of coyotes. A matured adult in either sex, when the fur is prime, appears, when first looked upon, to be comparable in weight to a smallest of the gray wolf forms in Sierra Madre and Mexican wolf, which occurs in Arizona and New Mexico. The wolves generally weigh between 60 and 90 pounds. Generally speaking, the coyote weighs between 18 and 30 pounds. Exceptionally heavy individuals do occur, noted by the following. A male coyote killed in February 1944 by Merle Forbes on his farm north of Bancroft in South Dakota weighed 42 pounds. See, for a Western coyote, guys, that is a monster. A male coyote taken near Jackson, Michigan, weighed 53.5 pounds. The heaviest coyote among the records obtained by the Fish and Wildlife Services is that a male weighed 74 pounds, killed in Wyoming in 1937. This animal was very fat and been killing sheep and measured 63 inches from tip to tip. Now that's not stretched. Other weights, 446 male coyotes from New Mexico averaged 24.4 pounds. 383 females from the same state averaged 22.2 pounds. New Mexico produced the largest male coyote, weighed 41 pounds. The largest female taken in Eddy County in New Mexico weighed 33 pounds. Seven male coyotes taken from 1917 on from the Wichita National Forest, southwestern Oklahoma, averaged 30.5 pounds. 93 coyotes in northwestern Oklahoma from 1947 averaged 25 pounds each, while 96 coyotes in the northeastern parts of the state during the same year averaged 27 pounds. That's a 2 pound difference in the same state. 38 females from the King Ranch in Texas weighed 17 to 32 pounds, on an average 23.14. 46 males from the same area weighed 18 to 42 as an average. I've trapped in Texas for years and I've never seen a 42 pound coyote. The average is 27.69. 14 in this group weighed 30 pounds each. Keep in mind, guys, this book was written in 1951. There's been a lot of things happen since 1951. When I was doing the study for the University of Georgia, all the coyotes that I caught in that study averaged 33 pounds. Actually, 33.3 pounds, if I remember correctly. 33 pounds. All the farmers around there thought they all weighed 50 pounds. But they don't. When you get in the northeast of the country, you definitely get into bigger genetics. But you also have to think, you have Bierman's Law going on. The farther away from the equator you get, animals have to be bigger to survive. They have to be. So when you're, that's the reason a coon here in Tennessee, we may average 10 coons out of 100, it'll be double X. Most of our coons are going to average between 27 and 30 inches stretched. You go up to Indiana and Illinois, they're tremendously bigger. You get up into South Dakota and northern Michigan and Maine, they got like little bears running around up there. And a lot of that has to do with the farther you get away from the equator, the bigger the animals are. Deer are bigger in the north than they are in the south. Coyotes are bigger in the north than they are in the south. All animals pretty much are bigger in the north than they are in the south. They need more body weight. They need more fat. They got to deal with more environment. And that's just the way that it is. So when you hear these numbers, keep in mind that it's not necessarily what they're going to be where you're at. And the thing that's always fascinated me about the weight of coyotes, just to be honest with you, is when I first started trapping, I was full bore drinking the Kool-Aid completely of Craig O'Gorman. I was an O'Gormanite to the end. And the way he talked about coyotes, the way he modified his traps, the way he welded, you know, J-hooks and did all this modification, because how bad a coyote can beat up a trap. Those aren't that big of coyotes. And at the same time, I see a lot of northern guys with stripped down versions of traps that aren't put together as well as he was doing. And they're going out and they're also catching coyotes with them, just not as much. And they seem to be doing okay. So I'm not sure where the really, you know, when trapping, you know, us trappers, we can overkill everything. But what is really needed to catch a coyote when you think about the average weight? You know, like here in the south, the average weight's going to be about 33 pounds. When you get in the west, they're going to be about 25 pounds. When you get up in north, I would say the average realistically is probably going to be 38 pounds. But you're going to have them in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And there's been one I've heard about, I think it was from Maine, but I'm not sure. It was bumping 70 pounds and it was a true coyote. So if you're in the farther north, just something to consider, guys. That's all I'm saying. Maybe you need to take a little bit of effort and picking your traps and or modifying your traps to be able to handle the abuse that a coyote can put on a trap when it's twice as big as what the Western guys have to deal with. Just something to think about just a little bit. Okay, coloration. I find this fascinating. Keep in mind again, this is 1951. The color pattern of the coyote varies less than in the large wolves, which is notoriously subject to melism and somewhat to climate restrictions. The predominant hair color is a light gray and red over parts of the body, with black and red interspersed of the body with black and white. Well, that sounds confusing. Attitude of habitat is a factor of a coyote's coloration. Those found in the higher elevations tend to be gray and black, while those in desert areas are more often whitish gray. Now, I can attest to this. When I was in the lower deserts, if you want to call them that, in New Mexico, about 4,800 feet, the coyotes were light gray, very white bottoms, very silky, beautiful animals. And when the one we caught some up in the mountains, they were much darker. And we're only talking, you know, a 4,000 foot difference. But you could drive from one elevation to the other in 10, 15 minutes. So it's not like we're going across the state, but that does seem to be true. The author has always felt that Merriam's description in 1897 of the coyote's color can be little improved upon when he wrote, "Muzzle dull, rather pale, finely sparkling with gray hairs, with black hairs chiefly on the cheeks, back of the head, in front of the eyes, to ears, grizzled gray, the pale zone underneath the under fur showing through, but the gray..." If I'm getting this light better. Let's see. Bring my black hairs. "The upper lip whitish, long hairs of the throat sparingly tipped with black, giving a broad collar a grizzled appearance, four legs and feet dirty white, becoming dull color on either side of the legs. Hind legs and feet dull on the outer sides, white on the inner sides, and a dorsal surface on the feet to change." So basically, he's just describing a common, more grayish coyote. It's not uncommon to find an albino among coyotes. When this occurs, it's generally only one in the litter. However, where more than one is in the litter has occurred, as that observation made by Harris, where the litter of coyote pups taken in western Nebraska by Charles Creeps of Boone, Nebraska, four were albinos. Instead of the eyes being pink, however, they were a milky blue in color. And they show a picture here of the albino coyotes. They look more like great big Arctic fox. Only one case of the other extreme, a black animal, is known to the author to pertain a single individual trapped in Colorado during the early 1920s. The eyes in this instance were also milky blue color. It is interesting to note that a total of 750,000 coyotes killed by federal and cooperative hunters during March 22 of 1938. In June 30 of 1945, only two albinos were captured in the main United States range of the animal. While albino coyotes appeared to be rare, albino coyotes have been captured in most of the western states, very often stated it is but in one in a litter, as one case of one killed by an automobile 5 years earlier in California. Among 1,672,604 coyotes taken by hunters, Fish and Game Wildlife Services between 1915 to June of 1945, only six albinos. Now, what they said about the black, see, I find this interesting. When you come to Tennessee, Kentucky, Mississippi, Alabama. I never caught a black one in Louisiana, so I'm not going to say that. Black coyotes are not uncommon, but they're not common either. But what I've noticed with the black coyotes, if I'm on a farm, like there was a farm, every single year in Marion County, Tennessee, I would catch a black coyote. On a farm in northern Alabama, every other year, almost like clockwork, I would catch a black coyote. Now, the interesting thing about every single black coyote that I caught is they had white right under their neck. Most of them had white on the tip of their tail, and a lot of them actually had white right around their feet. It didn't matter which state I caught them in, they all kind of looked the same. They did not have blue eyes, they had yellow eyes. I think a lot of the color variation that we see today as trappers comes from the aspect that if a male coyote dies, it's been shown in studies, that a female will breed with a dog. That's why you get funny looking heads, you get some that look more like Malamutes, you get some that look more like German Shepherds. That's the reason in the East, I believe, coyotes bark like a dog. You know, I've never heard a dog in the West bark. I've heard them howl and yip, but never bark like a dog. That is so common in the East. Because genetically, somewhere in their line, they mixed with a dog. So, like, when they're talking about these colors out West, it's a lot more uniform. All the coyotes that we caught in New Mexico, except for just a few, were identical to each other. Very white bellies, gray on the sides, a little bit of black on top. They were identical. Their hair texture was very silky, where ours in the East is not silky at all. It's more coarse. But sometimes you will catch a coyote, which I've done, and I've seen several at fur sales, where they're very silky, they're very long, and they don't look right, and they don't sell very well. We have a lot of coyotes, like in Kentucky, that are more orangish color. I can tell you the color differences of coyotes just here in Tennessee. When I go up to on top of the mountains, those coyotes are more gray and white. They bring higher money. When I get in the valley, they seem to mix more with dogs, and you get every color under the rainbow, it seems like, that the dog can be in. Browns and blacks and yellows and oranges and all these crazy colors. Now, the good thing for us trappers today is a lot of the coyotes are going to trim, and one of the big fads right now is turning that pink and purple and lime green and all kind of stuff. The Asians love that. So the color of the coyotes today are not as big as it was when you were trying to make coats out of them. Because back then, if you're going to make a coat out of a coyote, guys, it's really hard to do because you have to consistently match up coyote to coyote to coyote to be able to make a garment look good. So just something to think about when you're talking about coyotes. Now, this is where I find this. We're going to start getting what I consider some more interesting information. Coyotes appear to have the same lifespan as do larger wolves, 10 to 18 years. One kept in captivity in London Garden lived 12 years, 2 months, and 10 days, while a female and male kept in National Zoology Park in Washington, D.C. lived 14 years, 1 month, and 14 days. 14 years and 5 months and 2 days, respectively. The longevity records of coyotes kept in captivity are in Table 2. Now, these are captive coyotes. Years are everywhere from 6 to 18, averaging about 12 to 14. Chris Twillerson, a livestock operator in, San Luis Obispo, in Kern counties in California, took a male coyote pup from a den while on approaching maturity, became quite tame. It had been freedom of the ranch home and around the holdings on Twisted Something County Road. Here it lived for 17 years, dying but a short distance from the ranch home. So they live a long time, which for us as some trappers, that's something we need to pay attention to. When you go out and you sloppily put in coyote traps for speed, you're just not messing up that coyote if you do something wrong. If you educate that coyote, that coyote can educate the other coyotes that come from that den for 10, 12 years. That's why it's so frustrating when you're doing control work and you go behind pure amateurs, especially like down in Texas. They really don't know much about trapping. They know about snaring, but trapping's not their thing. And they go out and they do the craziest things you've ever seen. And then you as the ADC operator are dealt with 10 years of education because of something that was done 10 years ago. So when you're on a piece of ground, that's why I think it's advantageous for all trappers to really think about what they're doing when they're putting in sets. Make sure it's bedded well. Make sure if you're doing dirt holes, they're deep. Make sure that you mix up the lure so you're not having the same smell over and over again. Because a mistake you made today can cost you 10 years from now of coyotes not getting caught or much harder to catch. Strength, speed, and endurance. The old saying, the union there is strength. It is no better illusion than to be displayed in a teamwork among coyotes when obtaining prey. There is a plethora of information based on hundreds of observations concerning the trait of the animal. Forest Service studies in Rocky Mountains mule deer in Mudock County, California showed a lone coyote can kill a 200-pound buck if a wire fence is present to deflect the deer, and that two or more coyotes can kill a healthy buck in open country. Now, I can relate to this. When I've been on a lot of those high-fence places down in Texas, the way the coyotes mostly kill the deer is one of two ways. They either run the deer till one of the coyotes gets tired because the deer circles, and then that coyote will sit down and rest, and the other coyote will take off after that deer, and they will basically run the deer till it has a heart attack. They'll snipe at it some. They can draw some blood, but the most of the time in that big country down there, it's because they run the dang thing to death. The other thing coyotes have learned around fences, especially bigger fences, is if you can lead that deer towards a corner and panic him about 50, 60 yards out, he will hit the fence with such force that there is always dead deer in the corners of these big fences. And the ranchers find them all the time. Because the deer panics and tries to blow through the fence because they're 10 foot tall, and they literally hit the fence at such a run that it breaks their neck. So that's what they're doing. It is generally in pairs that coyotes proceed to chase and kill their prey. If a part of the coyote pursuit a deer upon crusting snowflake surfaces sufficient to stain their weight but not that of the heavier deer, they usually make a kill. Even a single coyote under light conditions is often successful as the prey flounders around and attempts firm footing. The uncanny and almost human-like craft employed by the coyote when hunting in pairs is no better illustrated and observed in the fall of 1929 on Charles Shelton's Antelope Range in northwest Nevada. On a small flat containing a dozen adult antelope, two coyotes were observed approaching from the windward side. As they neared the edge of the sagebrush surrounding the alkaline flat, which kept them concealed, one coyote separated from its companion, circling through the sagebrush and around as well as above the antelope. Now they came in downwind, the coyotes leaving scent upwind. When it reached the point below the herd, the other coyote, which had intentionally watched the movement of its companion, immediately sprang in the open and startled the herd, which swirled and started on a flat rut heading toward the other coyote hitting below. As the herd passed, it immediately gave pursuit and was close enough to grab one of the flanks of a passing doe. The two rolled over like a large snowball, giving sufficient time for the other coyotes to aid in its partner. Between the two of them, it was but a short time until the female antelope was so severely maimed that it became helpless and was greedily fed upon. From the point this was observed, it was strongly evident the antelope gave signs of life for a considerable time after a pair of coyotes started feeding upon it. Nature, I don't know why people think nature is so beautiful. It is to a point. It is freaking brutal. Because a lot of times when the coyotes eat deer, they're still alive. When they eat cows, they're alive. They're being eaten alive. I mean, that's like a torture technique the Taliban hadn't come up with. Many of the larger prey, such as deer and male antelope, while attacked, often succeed in making a getaway, as evidenced at the scene of an attack, which snow signs a terrific stubble, but no victim. In a running chase, it is doubtful that a single coyote can catch a jackrabbit in a fair race on open ground. When the coyote does overtake a jackrabbit, it generally is in terrain which covered with bunches of greasewood or other shrubs that enables a coyote to approach close to the rabbit, probably to catch it before it gets fairly started. The leap of the jackrabbit from 18 to 20 feet, as it's been measured, while leading a memorable journey across Western Africa, America, in 1806, was probably made by jackrabbits in full leap. The coyote in full jump makes approximately only 2/3 of that distance. It is the author's opinion that most jackrabbits are caught by the coyote when working in unison, while another coyote, as in the antelope. If the jackrabbit during the chase doesn't slip into a hole, he eventually becomes fagged and is overtaken. That's a weird word. As its endurance cannot outlast a pair of coyotes teamed up for its capture. Scott Zimmerman recorded a party of four men driving a light car across Utah desert, Lake Florida, giving chase to a coyote about 2 years old. For 47 minutes, the race kept up, at times showing a speed of 43 miles per hour. Wow. In the course of the chase, this animal turned, doubled, dodged to elude the pursuing car before finally becoming exhausted and killed. Canton records a coyote after a 2 mile chase by auto giving the last 0.6 mile of the race at 35 miles per hour. Harper records a statement by William Brown of Fort Smith McKenzie, who is noted for his prowess at running down on snowshoes such animals as moose and both species of caribou, as well as a wolf, but never overtook a coyote, which inevitably outdistanced him. As an interesting episode transferred 4 miles east of Saskatchewan, Canada, during January 1935. Here's a young farmer experienced in hunting and trapping rode down a coyote with a saddle pony at the end of a 7 mile run. He then attempted to make his pony stop upon the animal in hopes of killing it. However, this only resulted in the pony legs becoming badly mutated by the coyote's bites. So the rider finally had to dismount and kill the coyote with a pair of fence pliers. Reporting upon this observation in Yellowstone National Park, says a coyote carried a still warm but dead coyote, which had been killed by a buck deer a few moments previously, up a 30 degree slope for a distance of 28 yards at a dead run. Now we're going to talk about stamina. That a coyote sometimes survives what seems to be unusual odds against is shown recently captured in 1947 in New Mexico. Good grief, these words out there. Canajola. After being trapped It made its escape with a trap on its foot for 17 days. It carried the trap for the termination of which it succeeded in pulling out of it and went on its way. While traveling around with the trap on its paw, it fed upon blue jays, and the droppings were found in the bird's toenails, a piece of its own foot pad, some acorns, oak leaves, and sheep wool, and gopher hair.
Wow.
Swimming ability. See, I'm going to tell you a story about when I was doing a lot of snare in Squatchy County, Tennessee. We have the Squatchy River that flows through that county. And it meanders back and forth. And, of course, you know, it's a boundary. And there's a lot of covers, a lot of cats, a lot of coyotes. And what I was doing is they had big fields up to probably 25 feet of woods and brush. And the coyotes would run that river. And for about a year and a half, these trails would dead end into a side creek coming into it. And I never would really set that up because my brain was telling me that the coyote's not going to go down this trail and swim like a beaver to the other side and come up. But I was really wrong. Because one day I'm like, well, I'm going to see what this is. And I set the snare about like you would a beaver snare and blocked it in. It was taller, of course, you know, a 12-inch loop, 12 inches off the ground, right at the water's edge on both sides of that thing. And lo and behold, I doubled on a coyote catch where one was coming up out of the water and the other one was going into the water. The length of the water across this was about 25 feet, and it was way over my head. So if you're out trapping and snaring and you see what you think's a coyote trail, go into the water. Don't pass it up. The coyote is not timid when it's necessarily required to get in the water. Many observations show this animal to be a good swimmer, often exhibiting the trait when obtaining food. Koch in 1932 mentioned an outstanding record of coyotes swimming the Columbia River to raid poultry farms and returning the way they came. See, the reason I think this is so interesting is we as trappers today, for the most part, we think of water as a pure barrier. So our mindset's in a certain way where we see it as a barrier and we block off the possibilities of what the coyotes are actually doing. Just keep that in mind. Another observation showing the coyote to be a good swimmer in the case of a female that had denned on the canopy of a high sagebrush near lambing grounds used by Goshick and Holmes along the Green River in Wyoming. After the birth of the pups, the coyotes began to make periodic raids on both lambing herds. To do this, the coyote was compelled to swim the Green River, coming and going. In some instances, she swam the river with young lamb in her mouth to bring it to the den, or she would gorge on the lamb she killed, swim the river, and return to the den, disgorging the food to the pups. Here, the Green River, although wide and generally shallow, has nearly 6 foot depth in the narrow main channel. Bryant of 1920 records an observation of a coyote swimming a channel 30 feet wide and 8 feet deep of the Salton Sea, south of Southern California, concluding in this instance that the narrow channel of water formed no barrier during the food-getting expedition of the particular coyote, which in this instance was preying on waterfowl. Similar cases where the coyote was seeking waterfowl near nest or food that necessarily swimming narrow channels and wading in marshes have been noted in Colorado, particularly along Spring Creek. So we're going to stop there on the clever coyote. And I do apologize because I'm not the best reader, but it is, to me, it's important information for the trapper to know everything that they can about a coyote. You need to know their habits. You need to know their gestation periods. You need to know when they den. You need to know that they do swim. You need to know how they hunt. And I'll tell you why it's so important to know how they hunt. If you've got a big field and a farmer's got a ditch coming down the middle and he doesn't bush hog that and he lets it grow up, which a lot of farms do now, you're going to see that coyotes hunt in pairs, and you need to set your traps up to be ready for that. So if you're going out on a field and you see this big line of grass and there's a ditch or something in between there, yeah, you're going to look for the tractor roads that go across there and sure set those up. But when you set it up, regardless of the wind, you need to put a trap on both sides of the high grass in those big open fields. Because the way coyotes, and I've seen this myself, I've seen the tracks, I've heard farmers talk about it, so it's pretty common. Coyotes run down both sides, opposite sides of those big grass ditches, and they stay about shoulder to shoulder, and they do it at a good clip. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to get something to move, or they're going to win something. And if one's on the north side and it bolts to the south side, guess what it runs into? The other coyote. If it's a bigger prey like a deer, well, now they can start the chase, and they can use it where they have a coyote that rests while the other one runs it down, because it's going to come back. I mean, that's just the way that deer do. I don't know why they do that. It's just what they do. And the coyotes know that they do that. So when you see these big grass fields, part of the reason of knowing all these habits of coyotes is you know that you need to have traps on both sides regardless of the wind. If you don't, you're missing coyotes. Randy Smith is one of the ones that made this so apparent to me when we were doing his video, Combines and Coyotes. He always tried to set both sides of the field whenever it was possible. Sometimes one's on another piece of property and you can't set it. That's when you really try to find the roads and places that they can cross back and forth. When I learned that coyotes swam 25 foot of water, my coyote catch went up because I now had a new piece of ammunition in my belt that I could use when I see it. Now I'm staring right now at the Tennessee River. I don't think that a coyote on very regular basis is going to swim as far as this river is across. It's a half mile. But up and down this river, a lot of times only within a couple hundred yards of the bank, there's islands. And I do know that coyotes will swim out to those islands because there's not enough life to sustain a coyote on these islands, but I see coyote tracks out there periodically. And the way that the coyotes run the riverbanks here, which is pretty prolific, if they wanted to go check out something that was out in the water, I don't think they'd have any problem doing it. See, there's more to trapping to me than knowing how to make a set. It's how to look at an area and look at it from how a coyote's going to be working that thing. There was an instance with Chip. He had a student out there, and we were in a field. Good grief, I bet this thing was 1,000 acres, 500 acres. It was huge. I mean, it was massive. And there was a couple of roads down through there, and there was a few coyote traps on there. But with the student, Chip came across this little bitty erosion ditch because of all the rain. And it wasn't a ditch, like, I don't want you to think it's a man-made ditch. It's just where the water washed out in the winter, maybe 6-8 inches deeper than the rest of the field. And because it was wet there, because of this naturally occurring over time, there was little bitty stunted beans that were maybe 12 inches tall. That was it. That was the only cover. The rest of the field was basically an inch tall. Just plowed field, that's all it was. Well, Chip found several tracks coming and going, not on the road that was 30 feet away, but they were following that little bitty ditch when it was wet, they were in the bottom of this little ditch that was only at the most 12 inches wide. When it became really sloppy, they were right up on the edge of that ditch where it's only 2 or 3 inch difference in height. And they were using what little bitty bean stubble they could find, apparently as cover, because there's no food out there, to get from one section of the woods to the other. And Chip put some flat sets out there. And I don't know if he's caught anything or not. I hadn't heard one way or the other. But it was just fascinating to see the coyotes didn't do what the trapping book said they're going to do and work the road. Because there's traps on that road and there was no coyotes caught, at least while I was there on that road. The fresh tracks were in this little section of stunted beans that was not very thick, maybe 5 or 6 feet wide at most, with this little ditch running down through there. And the coyotes were coming back and forward on a daily basis. But what do we as trappers do? We run to the road, we put our traps on it, we run to the next intersection, we put the traps on it. The more you learn the habits, the more you see things like Chip found, the more you understand how coyotes are, the more interesting the game of trapping becomes. Because instead of mindlessly going from road to road to road and setting traps, you're looking at the terrain in a totally different way. And you're figuring out how the coyotes are getting from point A to point B and where you can catch them. Which brings up the point of why me and Jeff are so excited to be doing this trapping school next September in Iowa. That's the type of stuff that we want to help explain and help show trappers. We want to use all of this crazy experience with these crazy situations in all these different states to be able to show somebody all the stuff we've seen and learned and all the mistakes we've made so you can get the education without spending all the years that it took us to get. And at the same time, so you don't meet or you don't make the same mistakes that we did. That's why education in something like this is so powerful if you actually pay attention to what it is. Now I'm going to say a few things about going to a school. Whether you go to our school or someone else's school or you go to private instruction, whatever, if you're going to do something like that, about that. Guys, you know what you know when you show up. Because it's been your life, it's been your experiences, it's been your observations. But when you go to a school, and I've had a lot of students, and I've put on several schools before they were sexy, that's when you don't go into, I want to show what I know, but I want to learn what the teacher's learning. Because I guarantee a teacher's going to let you talk whatever you want to do. And at the same time, he's not going to tell you to not talk. But see, you're hurting yourself if you're trying to show what you do know. And at the same time, you're not taking in what the instructor says because you're in your brain trying to say what you do know. So it's going to be up to you as a student to understand. You leave with what you know, and then you need to leave with what the instructor knows. And if you're always trying to tell the instructor what you know, you're going to miss out on what he knows. So just keep that in mind, and I will talk to y'all next week.